Frank Sinatra, The Voice.
He knew from the single digits of his age that he was a genius, and his entire life was devoted to promoting that genius and becoming the greatest singer in the world. He had no lesser ambition than that.
That's James Kaplan. We'll spend the hour talking with him about his riveting biography of Sinatra, Frank the Voice, out from Doubleday in November 2010. And we'll be listening to some of Sinatra's singing, from his early years as part of Tommy Dorsey's orchestra, to our guest's own Sinatra favorites, arranged by Nelson Riddle. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I have a confession to make. I never paid much attention to Frank Sinatra. Coming of age in the 1960s, I thought of him as passé, a crooner to an older generation. Now, in my 60s myself, I've just discovered Sinatra's musical genius. I was motivated by James Kaplan's stellar biography of the singer, Frank the Voice. It's an 800-page tome that reads like fast-paced, hard-boiled fiction. It takes the reader on a fascinating journey through the life of one of America's greatest musical talents. It's a personal history, a cultural history, and a musical history of Frank's life, loves, and times, ones that will keep you reading with delight until the very end. Frank the Voice is the first volume of two. It begins with Sinatra's traumatic birth and his rocky, intense relationship with his mother, then goes on to recount his scrabble to get a toehold in the music industry and the ruthless ambition and musical genius that propelled him to the very top of the charts and into the hearts of millions of teenage Bobby Soxers. Then the fall, fueled by scandal and character assassination, and ending with Sinatra's near-miraculous comeback by way of Hollywood, with the Oscar nomination for From Here to Eternity. It's a wild ride, with stops along the way to delve into Sinatra's steamy love affairs, his grand passion with Ava Gardner, and his relationship with the mob, as well as his progressive political views. James Kaplan is the author of novels, essays, and nonfiction books, including Two Guys from Verona, The Airport, and the 2005 Dean and Me, A Love Story, co-written with Jerry Lewis. I've been telling people that this is actually the best biography I've ever read.
Oh, wow.
I know.
No, that's unbelievable. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, it is because in some ways I feel that the writing, the very style of writing, which is funny, it's eloquent, it's colloquial, it's a real blast to read. It almost seems like the style itself is completely in sync with a character who is its subject.
Yes, that's no accident.
Okay, tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I struggled for a while beginning this book, as most writers struggle beginning a book, and I had a false start that lasted several months where I didn't have the voice yet. But I had done a piece a couple of years ago for Vanity Fair about the songwriter Jimmy Van Heusen. It was part of my research for this book. And when I did that piece, I sort of quickly and naturally settled into a, I don't mean to make it sound too artificial, but kind of a tough and swinging style that seemed to be consonant with Jimmy Van Heusen himself, who very much lived as he wrote his music. And so when I floundered a little bit with the beginning of Frank, I was speaking to my brother, who is an editor and who has been a great advisor to me, and he said, just write it like that piece. And so that was kind of a revelation to me.
It's terrific, and it's such a pleasure to read, and it's a very long book, 750 pages, and you just go to 1954. And you have a sequel in the works, is that right?
Yeah, yes. It's a 60-year career. It's a gigantic life. It's a life that touches on every aspect of American culture and history in the 20th century. And so my original contract with Doubleday said, Life of Frank Sinatra, 352 pages. And after I had done... I did 3 years of research before I set pen to paper, and I knew right away that I had a big white whale by the tail here.
Yeah, you did. Now, this must be in some ways an obsession for you. What got you into this story?
About 10 years ago, I did a profile for the New Yorker of Jerry Lewis. It was a piece that came kind of out of the blue for me. It came through a mutual friend of mine and Jerry Lewis's, Peter Bogdanovich, the movie director and writer. And in the process of doing that profile, I became close to Jerry Lewis. We wound up speaking a lot about Frank Sinatra, to whom Jerry had been close. And Jerry would always speak of him as Frank, to the point where, by kind of, I guess, almost Stockholm syndrome, I began to think of Sinatra as Frank myself. And then I would catch myself and think, well, no, he's not Frank to you. But a couple of years after I did that piece, Jerry Lewis called me out of the blue one afternoon and asked if I would help him with his book. And I knew instantly what he was talking about. He had been working forever on a memoir of his partnership with Dean Martin. I instantly said, yes, of course, I'll help you with your book. And what came out of that was Lewis's memoir, Dean and Me. As we were finishing that up, Jerry invited me to the 2004 Labor Day Telethon, which that year was being held in Los Angeles. And one night while I was out there, I went out to dinner, not with Jerry, but with a bunch of musicians who were working on the show. They have a big band that plays for the telethon. And we went to an Italian restaurant in Santa Monica, and much food and much alcohol was consumed, and it was a delightful occasion. I was just there as a guy, not as a journalist, and very rowdy. And about an hour or two into the dinner, it turned out that every one of these musicians had worked with Sinatra. So I kind of inwardly rubbed my hands, thinking, okay, here comes the gossip about the women and the mob and the fistfights. And instead, every one of these guys spoke in almost hushed tones, tones of awe, about what an absolute musical genius this man had been, this man who couldn't even read a note of music. And I was very moved by this. I was very struck by it. And it was coming time for me to do my next book. It was around the time that a new biography of Sinatra had come out and gotten slammed by the New York Times. And the reviewer said the definitive biography of Frank Sinatra has yet to be written. So being no shrinking violet, I guess, but never having really done a full-scale biography, I had only done two assisted autobiographies, Jerry Lewis's and John McEnroe's, along with dozens upon dozens of magazine profiles, I decided to take this on. I thought it would be interesting to try, not only interesting, but I thought it would be fascinating to try and get the genius onto the page.
You really did. I mean, this book goes over personal history, cultural history. I'm learning so much about the music of that period. And I have to say, I'm not somebody who really... I didn't grow up in a popular culture household.
Mm.
I was, I think, 13, around 13, when the Beatles phenomenon, the Screaming Girls with the Beatles phenomenon happened. I was never part of that. So I didn't really know that much about Frank Sinatra, and I'm totally into him now, thanks to your book, and been listening to his wonderful, wonderful music.
Yeah, I grew up in a household where all kinds of things were listened to, from classical to Broadway, and certainly popular music. but I was enraptured when the Beatles came along. I'm the same age as you, and I was crazy about rock and roll, and continue to be so to this day. But I guess one thing that I have learned over the years, for myself anyway, I'm not going to proselytize, is that divisions in music are illusory, really, and that genius is genius wherever we find it, whether it's whether it's Maria Callas or Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, and the respect for that genius is so palpable in your book. But let's start at the beginning here. I was surprised to find out, and probably many people would be, I knew that Frank Sinatra was born in Hoboken, New Jersey, but I didn't know that he came from a poor, that he did not come from a poor, poor working class background. That just always seemed to be, part of the mystique that he would have. Tell us about his family, where he came from.
Yeah, well, that was a mystique that he worked very hard to promote himself. He was an ex. Exquisitely sensitive genius who in later life said that at the age of 9 he heard the music of the spheres. But there he was, 9 years old, Hoboken, New Jersey, in the mid-1920s. It was a tough town. It was a blue-collar, working-class town, a port town. We've all seen On the Waterfront. It was a rough place, and so it wouldn't do to be walking around listening to the music of the spheres. His Sinatra was 13 and a half pounds at birth, and he had a very rough birth. He was a forceps baby, badly scarred by the delivery, and I think his mother decided she didn't want to have to go through that again. So he was an only child. An only child in an Italian-American family in the 1920s in Hoboken, New Jersey. An extreme rarity. His mother, Dolly Sinatra, was a force of nature. His father, Marty, was a pleasant man, but not very assertive and not very interesting. Dolly was a brilliant woman and a fiery woman. She was politically very active. She was a passionate Democrat, passionate suffragist, once chained herself to a fence to protest that women didn't have the vote. She became a ward leader, Democratic ward leader in Hoboken. She made a living for the family with a practice as a midwife and an abortionist, which was very much under the table in those days, but she made a good living at it. She was extremely ambitious for the family, and by force of will, moved her little family, the three of them, from tenement in the Italian-American section in Hoboken to a better house and then a better house still. Very upwardly mobile, and by the time Frank was in his early teens, the family lived in a very nice townhouse in Hoboken. They had a grand piano, they had nice furniture. It was a very middle class existence, and Frank was in many ways a pampered only child. At the same time, Dolly, having the fiery temperament she had and a hair trigger temper, Sinatra said in later years he never knew whether she was going to hug him or hit him. So it was an odd childhood. He was always superbly dressed. He had a charge account at the best clothing store in Hoboken. His mother bought him a convertible when he was 15 years old. She bought him musical arrangements and a sound system so he could pursue his ambition as a singer. At the same time, both his father and mother called him a bum because he wasn't interested in earning a living. It was a singular upbringing. It was not. He didn't run with street gangs, and he wasn't poor.
We're talking with James Kaplan, his terrific biography, the first of two, the first part of two, is Frank the Voice. Do you think his relationship with his mother, and maybe also with his father, had something to do with his success, with his drive for ambition as well?
Absolutely. I think his mother had everything to do with it. As we've seen, Dolly Sinatra was tremendously ambitious herself. He inherited many of her characteristics, her temper, her fiery temperament, her impatience. He He was also, I think, diagnostically obsessive-compulsive and diagnostically manic-depressive. He knew from the single digits of his age that he was a genius, and his entire life was devoted to promoting that genius and becoming the greatest singer in the world. He had no lesser ambition than that, and he was furiously ambitious even as he achieved more and more.
His mother, as you say, bought him a car at the age of 15 that had a singular role in him getting his first toehold into show business, but he really had to claw his way in. Tell us about what happened in the beginning, and then I'm going to ask you about what his real lucky break was.
He was a pest. He was there. Every great man or woman comes from a small place, and very often comes from a place where the people they know sort of deride them, look down on them. Oh, he or she was no better than us, just one of us. And that's very much how the citizens of Hoboken felt about Frank Sinatra. He was a pest. He was clearly, patently an egomaniac. His idol was Bing Crosby, so from an early age he was walking around imitating Crosby's yachting cap. He would stick a pipe in his mouth just like Crosby. You may remember that the citizens of Oxford, Mississippi used to call William Faulkner Count No Count. That's what they called William Faulkner, because Faulkner used to strut around like he was somebody. Well, it was very much the same with Sinatra. He strutted around like he was somebody. He was desperate to get singing jobs. He could sing on key, but his voice at first was small and weak, and musicians just thought he was, as I said, a pest. And a lot of them, I even interviewed a couple of people who remembered very clearly relatives of theirs telling Frank Sinatra to go away. But he persisted, and because of his mother, he had this convertible, he had musical arrangements, and he had this primitive sound system, a microphone, an amplifier, and that got him in with musicians. He could get jobs singing with bands, small bands in clubs around Hoboken and Jersey City, simply because he had these things.
And then he caught a lucky break. Fast forward a bit, because I think it was kind of a two-step break. He first got into a band that was well known, but on its way out, and that led him to Chicago and Tommy Dorsey.
Yes, there were a couple of steps though along the way. He got in with a band called the Three Flashes. He became the Fourth Flash. They got a spot on what was the American Idol of the day, Major Bowes Radio Amateur Hour, national broadcast. They won. It was a huge deal at the time. They won the talent contest. And Sinatra went out on the road with they had been the Four Flashes. They became the Hoboken Four. That was short-lived. He got a job in a nightclub on the Palisades in New Jersey called the Rustic Cabin. He was a singing waiter there, and he was a singing waiter for several years until one night a great band leader and trumpeter named Harry James walked through the door, having heard Sinatra singing on the radio. There was a radio hookup at the Rustic Cabin, and Harry James hired him for his band. Now, Harry James was a great band leader and a great trumpeter, but he was a terrible businessman, and the band fell apart after a few months because Harry James ran out of money. And at that point, Sinatra got hired by the greatest band leader in the land, Tommy Dorsey.
And that was a kind of fraught relationship, a very close one and a difficult one.
Tommy Dorsey was a superstar. That word didn't exist in those days, that vulgar word, but Tommy Dorsey was one. He was a regal presence. He was a great trombonist. He fronted his band. He was the star of his band. He heard Sinatra singing on the radio. He thought, this is a great voice. In those days, band singers, whether they call them girl singers and boy singers, were secondary to a big band. They would come on and do their vocal after the star, Tommy Dorsey, had played his long trombone intro. Frank Sinatra from the beginning idolized Tommy Dorsey. He was the strong father that Frank Sinatra's weak father really never had been. Tommy Dorsey was an elegant man, a commanding man, a great businessman, a great musician, and Sinatra imitated everything he could about Tommy Dorsey, his bearing, his wardrobe, beautiful wardrobe, even his cologne and his toothpaste. But mainly, what Sinatra wanted to figure out how to imitate was Dorsey's incredible breath control. Dorsey, the trombonist, could play a 32-bar legato, and Sinatra, from the outset of his career, felt that breath control was essential to making a singer sound natural and be able to convey the meaning of a song.
And when you say the meaning of the song, too, that's something he really worked on.
He studied the lyric of a song as if it were a poem. He studied the lyric deeply before he ever sang a note of music. He came to inhabit that lyric. And so between his amazing breath control, and he did, Sinatra did manage to learn how to hold a note for incredibly long time. I would suggest to anybody listening to Sinatra, listen to some of his recordings from the 40s and 50s, and try to sing along with them. Try to hold some of those notes. You'll start laughing at yourself. Incredible breath control. He studied that lyric, and the combination of that, his insistence on perfect diction in a song, on knowing the lyric, on controlling his breath, all of those things, those are technical things. The combination of those things with the complication of his personality, his great vulnerability, made for a singing style like nobody else's.
Fools rush in where angels fear to tread, and so I come to you, my love, my heart above my head. I see the danger there. If there's a chance for me, then I don't care. Fools rush in where wise men never go, but wise men never fall in love. So how are they to know? When we met, I felt my life begin. So open up your heart and let this fool rush in.
That was Fool's Rush In from Volume 1 of Tommy Dorsey, Frank Sinatra, The Complete Studio Masters. We're talking about Frank Sinatra with biographer James Kaplan. He's the author of Frank, The Voice, the first volume of a 2-volume biography of the singer. Now, we were talking about Tommy Dorsey. Dorsey ended up feeling pretty betrayed by Sinatra, something that he might have been one of the first to feel that way, but he certainly wasn't the last. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, how you see Sinatra's willingness to latch onto people and then throw them away in the context of his character and his success?
Everything was about promoting his career, and so the career always came first. Friends, lovers, mentors, father figures all came second. Tommy Dorsey was enormously important to Sinatra, but what was even more important was his career. About a year into his gig with Tommy Dorsey, this is the early 1940s, the worm turned. Something amazing happened. Dorsey had been the star of the band, but suddenly in the land, in America, there was this new group of teenagers who, you know, Bing Crosby came about as a phenomenon during the Depression. Nobody had any money. Sinatra hit. Depression was over. World War II had started. Teenagers suddenly had a couple of nickels to rub together. They could afford to buy records. And teenage girls, in particular, were stunned by Sinatra. And so what began to happen at Dorsey's gigs was whenever Sinatra began to sing, the girls would press forward toward the bandstand. They would scream. Sometimes they would even faint. Dorsey at first thought it was funny. He would have his musicians imitate the screaming and fainting back at the girls. But Sinatra became the star of the band. And Sinatra conceived this idea, nobody had ever done it before, that he could go out on his own and become a singer on his own. He could leave Dorsey. Dorsey was furious.
James Kaplan. We'll talk more with him about his biography of Frank Sinatra, Frank the Voice, after the break. Meanwhile, let's hear a recording of Sinatra's goodbye to Tommy Dorsey.
And speaking of the Wild West, here's Side Saddle Sinatra, the Hoboken Bronco Buster. How's tricks, S.S.?
Oh, I'm a sad hombre tonight, boss. I got moths in my chaps and even my spurs won't jingle jangle.
Well, Frank, I can understand that. Folks, this is Frank Sinatra's farewell broadcast with his band. After tonight, he's going to be strictly on his own. And, Frank, I want to tell you that everyone in the band wishes you the best of luck.
Thanks, Mac, and I'd like to say that I'm going to miss all you guys after kicking around for 3 years. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like you to meet the boy who's going to take my place as the vocalist with Tommy in the band. He's a fine guy, a wonderful singer, and he was good enough for Harry James and Benny Goodman, and that's really saying plenty. Folks, I'd like you to meet Dick Hames.
Well, Frank, I don't know if anyone can really take your place with this band, but I'm going to be in there trying. You can bet on that. As for you, well, I know that you'll be knocking them dead on your own hook.
So, thanks, Dick.
I agree with you there, Dick, and thanks a lot, Dick Hames. Frank, before you hit the road, how about one more song just for Auld Lang Syne?
That's all right with me, Tom. Give me the beat on our arrangement of the song as you, and I'll see what I can do with it.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with James Kaplan. His terrific biography of Frank Sinatra is called Frank the Voice. We're talking to him about the first volume in what will be a two-volume biography. So he went out on his own. He began perfecting his technique. The way he could connect to an audience was phenomenal. And it went, when he went out on his own, it went from the screaming girls. He broke into the adult audience. There's a marvelous scene you paint in the book where he's on the rooftop of, is it the Waldorf Astoria?
It's the Hotel Astor.
Hotel Astor, that's
Hotel
right.
Hotel Astor in May of 1940. He had made the girls scream. They didn't have the word superstar then. They didn't have the word teeny bopper. Instead, they called them bobby soxers. So these girls who wore these little short white socks, they were the bobby soxers. Sinatra knew that he could wow them, but he and the Dorsey band had this engagement at the Hotel Astor, which was the fanciest or one of the fanciest hotels in New York at the time. There was a club on the roof of the hotel and a nightclub, and the band and Sinatra were to play there, and Sinatra was petrified because the clientele there was not going to be teenage girls. It was the society swells of New York. New York New York in those days really had an upper crust and very snobby group they were. And this was the clientele of the Hotel Astor Roof. They came out to hear Sinatra in May of 1940, I think initially a little amused at this underweight young Italian-American singer. And before they knew it, this crowd of society swells were completely not only won over, but awestruck at Sinatra's vocal abilities.
Yeah, and now you mentioned Italian-American there. This was a time when Italian-American, there was a tremendous amount of prejudice against Italian-Americans, something Frank Sinatra grew up with, even if he grew up in a middle-class home. Here he's confronting the creme de la creme of WASP New York.
Yeah.
Talk about the prejudice that he had experienced as an Italian-American and the impact that had on his politics, I would say. You know, he really understood the need for tolerance.
This is another similarity to his mother. You know, so many members of despised or underestimated ethnic groups take it upon themselves to despise other ethnic groups, and so it has been very easy throughout our history for the Irish Americans to hate the Italian Americans, or the Italian Americans to hate the African Americans. Sinatra was, I guess, because of his mother, largely he was a big D Democrat from an early age. He believed deeply in tolerance. He also, as a young man, spent a lot of time on 52nd Street in Manhattan, which in those days, 52nd Street between 5th Avenue and 6th Avenue was a glorious block full of jazz clubs, jazz club after jazz club, and the players and the singers in these jazz clubs were largely African American. And Sinatra was, he haunted these clubs, and he heard Billie Holiday sing, he heard Teddy Wilson play the piano, he heard Lester Young, he heard all these black geniuses. He knew they were geniuses, and he idolized Billie Holiday. He learned a lot about singing from her. He knew in his bones that racial prejudice was asinine, and felt that in his entire life. It was really, he really did walk the walk. He didn't just talk the talk. He there are all kinds of stories about people making anti-black remarks, people making anti-Semitic remarks in Sinatra's presence, and Sinatra punching the person out. He felt very passionately, as a member of a despised minority himself, that these other minorities were no worse than he was.
I'm not the guy who cared about love, and I'm not the guy who cared about fortunes and such. Never cared much.
Oh, look at you now.
I never knew the technique of kissing. I never knew the thrill I could get from your touch. Never knew much.
Oh, look at you now. You're a new man, better than Casanova at his best.
With a new heart, a brand new start, I'm so proud I'm busting my vest.
So you're the guy who turned out a lover.
Yes, I'm the guy who laughed at those blue diamond rings. One of those things.
But look at you now.
Frank Sinatra singing, Oh, Look at Me Now, with Connie Haine and the Pied Pipers. We haven't talked much about his personal life as an adult yet, and it was a pretty seamy one. Well, I don't know if that's really the steamy is more what I would say.
Seamy is very that we're making it's judgmental. The
right.
word seamy, steamy for sure.
Yeah, no, steamy is it. Now he was a great womanizer, a Lothario, one could say. He was a great lover of women. I mean, there were certainly many women that he slept with who, you know, women who threw themselves at him and he obliged, but he also was a very great, deep lover. Talk about his relationship to the women who played, you know, a very important part in his life, his first wife, of course, and then Ava Gardner.
Well, I think that, you know, he married very young. He married Nancy Barbato in 1939 when he was 23 years old. She was all of 21 or 22 when they married. I think that they were in love, but this was the beginning of Sinatra's career at the same time as the beginning of his marriage. And from the beginning of his career, the girls, the women, were throwing themselves at him. He had something that just galvanized women. He was underweight. He was small. He was short. He was skinny. He looked like he could use a good meal. He weighed about 127 pounds. But he had those electric blue eyes. He had the ability to convey in his singing in an intense vulnerability, an intense romanticism that just made women flock to him and fall into bed with him. And he obliged. He never turned them away. This began happening at the beginning of his marriage. At first, I think Nancy Sinatra thought that she would forgive his peccadilloes as long as he came home to her. But after a while, the adulteries just became too blatant, and she at a certain point couldn't take it anymore. Ava Gardner was an extraordinary phenomenon, physical phenomenon. I interviewed several people who spent time with her, and just said that one woman I spoke to said that it was amazing just to watch Ava Gardner walk across a room. She was the most beautiful woman in 100 years, a real phenomenon. And when she and Frank Sinatra first met, I think that proverbial thunderbolt happened. It took them a while to get together, but once they did, there was the flash of a chemical reaction, and they couldn't stay away from each other. And that was effectively the end of Frank Sinatra's marriage.
But his infidelities continued and led ultimately to the end of his marriage with Ava Gardner.
Yes, well, he and Ava Gardner were very similar. They were all too similar. They were both crazy about sex. They were both probably alcoholic. They hated to sleep. They said whatever was on their mind. They were great pleasure lovers. They were also both politically very liberal. They were a great match for each other in many ways, but they pushed all each other's buttons, both positive and negative. They were, as I say in the book, they were an unstable chemical compound that was fated never to bond. They were never going to be that couple who settled down behind a white picket fence and raised kids. It just wasn't going to happen. It should be acknowledged, speaking perhaps from a feminist or post-feminist standpoint, that Ava Gardner gave as good as she got. She was every bit as promiscuous in her heart, in her mind, and in her actions as Frank Sinatra was. She wrote in her memoirs that if she had been content to share Frank with other women, they would have stayed together. But the same could have been said about her. If he had been content to share her with other men, they could have stayed together. And the truth is, they never could have stayed together.
Yeah, that was one of those grand romances, doomed from the start.
I think they never really got over each other to the end of Ava Gardner's days. She died in 1990, at the age of 68, and Sinatra, I think, in a certain way, was always in love with her.
Yeah.
What a world, what a life, I'm in love. I got a song that I sing, I can make the rain go anytime I move my finger. Lucky me, can't you see I'm in love? Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I hold the string. I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let it go. I got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love. Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I hold the string. I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let it go. I got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world. Man, this is a lie. Hey now, I'm so in love.
Sinatra singing, I've Got the World on a String. That's off the 1956 album, This is Sinatra, from Capitol Records. Now, I don't think we can do an interview about a book about Frank Sinatra without talking about the mob. You put his relationship to the mob into context, neither, you know, exaggerating nor minimizing it. Talk about that and tell us about his trip to Havana in 1947.
Sinatra was an Italian-American at a time when Italian-Americans weren't even legally considered white in this country. He was a short and slight man. Even though he was quick with his fists, he wasn't a particularly great fist fighter. He looked upon these mobsters with whom he came in contact early in his career, and it should be noted, by the way, that now in this age where the institution of the nightclub has basically vanished, that nightclubs were once kind of the backbone of the American entertainment culture in this country. People went out to clubs, and the clubs were run by the mob. So in those days, any entertainer who worked a nightclub came in contact with the mob. Sinatra, though, had a real pull toward these men. Many of them were Italian-American, and he saw them, he idolized them. Much the same way as a young boy idolizes cowboys. They were tough guys. They were men of power. Sinatra saw them as men of honor. It's not like the book or the movie The Godfather, but he had a kind of godfather and a North Jersey mobster named Willie Moretti. In 1947, Sinatra was invited and accepted the invitation, unfortunately, to attend a mafia summit in Havana, Cuba, the cover story for the summit was that it was going to be these men were all going to hear a concert by Sinatra. In fact, they were all going to pay tribute to Lucky Luciano, a columnist for the Hearst newspapers named Robert Ruark, later to become a well-known novelist. He's a young man. He happened to be in Havana at the time and happened to sight Sinatra sitting at a restaurant table with Lucky Luciano and began writing dispatches back to the Hearst newspapers, which, by the way, were very politically conservative and disposed to dislike Sinatra on that basis. Well, now they really had ammunition. He was fraternizing with the mob.
Now, some people have said that he got his Academy Award-winning part for From Here to Eternity through the intercession of the mob. You put that rumor to rest. We haven't really talked about his acting career. Tell us something about it. He ended up not only being a great singer, but being a terrific actor.
He was, almost despite himself. You know, his singing always came first. Making records was his passion. He would work on a record as long as it took. If it took 20 takes, he would do 20 takes. But he went into the movies kind of as an engine for his career. Almost cynically, he early on in his career, he was with MGM, and he was singing and dancing on the screen, often wearing a sailor suit next to Gene Kelly. He wasn't looked upon as a serious actor. His career, because of the mafia revelations, because of his leaving his wife and family for Ava Gardner in the late 40s and early 50s, his career really sank almost out of sight, and he was broke. He was dropped by his movie studio, his agents, his record label. He was really nowhere when he read this big new novel, From Here to Eternity, found a character in it named Angelo Maggio, who was a tough little wisecracking Italian-American from Brooklyn, totally identified with the character, felt that Frank Sinatra, was destined to play Maggio in the movie, and began barraging Columbia Pictures with telegrams signing them Maggio. Ava Gardner, who was beginning to get tired of Frank Sinatra because his career was, she was supporting him. Her career was shooting upwards, his was shooting downwards, and their great romance had begun to hit the skids, but she still loved him, I think. She went to Harry Cohn, the head of Columbia Pictures, and said that she would give Harry Cohn a free picture if Harry Cohn would give Sinatra a screen test. And Harry Cohn, who was a noted lech in Hollywood, took one look at Ava Gardner and thought, well, what else could he get for free? And he gave Sinatra a screen test, and Sinatra nailed the screen test. There was no horse's head in anybody's bed. Sinatra's getting the role largely had to do with that amazing screen test, with Ava Gardner's campaign, with the telegrams, and with the fact that Sinatra agreed to do the picture for almost nothing, just expenses, because he was so down on his luck.
Wow.
Nominees for the best performance by an actor in a supporting role are Eddie Albert in Roman Holiday, Paramount, Brandon DeWilda in Shane, Paramount, Frank Sinatra in From Here to Eternity, Columbia, and Robert Strauss in Stalag 17, Paramount. And who, please, is the winner? The winner is Frank Sinatra in From Here to Eternity.
That's a clever opening. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm deeply thrilled and very moved, and I really, really don't know what to say, because this is a whole new kind of thing, you know, I song and dance man type stuff. And I'm terribly pleased, and if I start thanking everybody, I'll do a one-reeler up here, so I better not. And I'd just like to say, however, that they're doing a lot of songs here tonight, but nobody asked me. And I love you, though. Thank you very much. I'm absolutely thrilled. Thank you.
Frank Sinatra winning the Oscar for Best Actor in 1953. Now, that is the story of him getting the Academy Award for From Here to Eternity. Ends the book. What's going to be the focus of the next volume? Do you know that yet?
The next volume is a darker book. It's a tougher book. It is a book. It is a book that is about more of the things that more people, I think, associate with Sinatra than they do with the story I told in the first book, which is very much a story about the young Sinatra, the skinny Sinatra, Sinatra with hair, whose career was just rising. The second book is about the Sinatra who is beginning to make this astonishing series of great records and albums for Capitol Records, along with the great arranger Nelson Riddle. It is the Vegas Sinatra, the Ring-a-Ding-Ding Sinatra. It's a story of Las Vegas. It's a story of Sinatra and the Kennedys and the dissolution of that relationship. It's a darker and perhaps a more existential book. It's a story about Sinatra post Ava Gardner and Sinatra alone becoming tougher and maybe a little more cynical, becoming the swinger of the Western world, and ultimately I think settling into a middle age where he has become an American institution.
I can't wait to read that one, and I hope you'll be back on the show for that as well.
In a flash, Francesca.
That's great. And finally, do you have a favorite song of Frank Sinatra or a favorite rendition of a song?
I am particularly partial to his work with Nelson Riddle. There are so many great songs he did with Nelson Riddle and Capitol. I would pick two out of the air, which to my mind are incomparably great renditions of great songs. One is the Nelson Riddle arrangement of the great Ruby Bloom, Johnny Mercer song, Day In, Day Out. And the other is the great Nelson Riddle arrangement of the great Johnny Burke, Jimmy Van Heusen song, Here's That Rainy Day. What you have there is, in each case, is just it's just a meeting of geniuses and a genius rendition of a genius song.
Well, James Kaplan, your book is Frank the Voice. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much, Francesca. It was a great pleasure.
James Kaplan. Volume 2 of his biography of Frank Sinatra will be titled Sinatra, the Chairman of the Board. It's due out in 2014. You can read an excerpt from Volume 1, Frank the Voice, at writersvoice.net. Let's go out on James Kaplan's two favorites among Sinatra's songs, Day In, Day Out, and Here's That Rainy Day, both arranged by Nelson Riddle.
Day in, day out, same old hoodoo follows me about. Same old pounding in my heart whenever I think of you. And darling, I think of you day in and day out. Day out, day in. I needn't tell you how my days begin. When I awaken with a tingle. One possibility in view. That possibility of maybe seeing you. Come rain, come shine, I meet you and to me the day is fine. Then I kiss your lips and the pounding becomes the ocean's roar, a thousand drums. Can't you see it's love? Can there be any doubt when there it is, day in, day out?
holiday is fine. Then I kiss those lips and the pounding becomes a large ocean's roar. 9,000 drums. Can't you see that it's love? Can there be any doubt when there it is?
I should have saved those leftover dreams. Funny, but here's that rainy day. Here's that rainy day. They told about, and I laughed at the thought that it might turn out this way. Where is that worn out wish that I threw aside after it brought my love so near? Funny how love becomes a cold rainy day. Funny, that rainy day is
sung by Frank Sinatra. And you can now find Writer's Voice on Twitter and Facebook. Just key in Writer's Voice, but leave out the apostrophe. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.